I'm delighted to introduce another Coots in Conversation. Now, just now, absolutely a key theme running through our perception of the COVID-19 crisis and its handling is the interaction between decision makers, politicians, and scientists, and between both scientists and decision takers and the public. We have with us today possibly two of the best people we could possibly find who know about both kinds of interface, public and science, and politicians' public and science, namely Brian Cox, first-ranked physicist and with a professorship at Manchester University, where Rutherford split the atom and various other things have happened since then, and a brilliant communicator of science, as we all know, as the Royal Society's Professor of Public Engagement in Science. And we have Nancy Rothwell, President and Vice Chancellor of Manchester University and co-chair with Patrick Vallance of the Prime Minister's Council for Science and Technology, which, to blow my own trumpet for a moment, I established as Minister of Science in 1993. Both can talk from first-hand experience about the actual doing of science. They're both distinguished scientists, but they also know about the interaction between science and decision-taking. And steering the discussion today is one of our clients, Vikas Shah, entrepreneur, philanthropist, and an honorary professor at Manchester University. So we are having a bit of a northern conversation today, though we'll probably keep off the premiership. Vikas is a practiced interviewer, as you will discover, and I strongly recommend his website, Thought Economics, where he publishes detailed interviews with the individuals who have shaped our century. So over to you, Vikas.
Thank you very much, William, for that wonderful introduction. And also, you know, thank you to Nancy and Brian for joining us today. And I'd just like to start with a question for you, Nancy, which is, you know, the current COVID crisis is impacting universities in a really profound way. And it'd be great just to get some of your insights on how universities are responding to this. And is it going to change what we see as the business model for universities in the future?
So most universities, like the University of Manchester, responded really fast. We moved very, very quickly to online learning, online assessment. We closed most of our research labs, but kept open an ever-growing activity trying to understand COVID-19, whether it is why some people get such bad symptoms and some people don't, what are the potential treatments, we're involved in development of a vaccine, and so on. How will it change things? There are practical ways, just like the way we operate now. There will be more done online, more done virtually. We'll be traveling less, which is a good thing for the planet, as well as our time and everything else. But I do feel, as I've said in other fora, there is a potential discontinuity here where it gives us an opportunity to really rethink the way that universities operate. And if I was going to use one word that I think might summarize the future, it's collaboration. I think we've been driven to some extent down a route of all competing with each other on everything. And if we're going to really solve today's and tomorrow's problems and teach the next generation, we need to work together more on it.
And it's also opening up new areas of research, isn't it, in terms of, you know, seeing the new priorities for our world and for universities. Would that be the case that you've experienced as well?
Definitely, obviously, infectious disease is absolutely at the forefront. And some of you will have seen in the news the slightly scary potential, very limited at the moment, for yet another form of flu that is coming out. But actually, many universities like ours are shifting also towards understanding climate change. And increasingly now, about the importance of the humanities. You know, we all talk about science, Brian and I are both scientists, but actually humanities are incredibly important in this. As we try to rebuild our communities, as we try to support a whole cohort of students and young people who've missed out on part of their education.
And Brian, we'll come to you in just one moment and to start to talk about, you know, science and how this relates to today's conversation. But just before we go to that, Nancy, you know, I know a lot of our listeners and viewers today, you know, have got children who are going into university. What would be kind of your words of reassurance for them about this upcoming autumn term? Because I know there's still a lot of uncertainty in people's minds about what to expect when that arrives.
Yeah, understandably, and much could change over the next few months. I think the key point I would make is we're absolutely there to look after the students and there to be flexible and adaptable. So if students can't start immediately but want to, they can start online and join us as soon as they're ready. We've had over 1,000 students stayed with us throughout the pandemic because they've been in our residences and have been unable to travel. And we've been looking after them very well, and they're fine. And they've had online learning, they've had access to facilities and so on. We'll do our very best to make it a completely normal experience, but obviously we'll be flexible because the first and most important thing is safety of all students.
Absolutely. And Brian, 2010, you did one of my favourite TED Talks, which looked at the importance of curiosity-led science. And in that TED Talk, and if you allow me to quote, you said, "We know we live in difficult and challenging economic times. One of the first victims of those times is public spending of any kind, but certainly in the firing line is public spending on science, and particularly curiosity-led science and exploration." And I thought that was really interesting, you know, and it'd be great just to hear from you on what does that mean? You know, what do you mean when you refer to curiosity-led science and exploration?
Well, one thing to say is those, although I made the distinction myself in 2010, it's really quite an old-fashioned and not appropriate way of thinking, I think, about the generation of knowledge. And this is the key point in answering your question. In my mind, if we just talk very broadly about what science is, it's an attempt to understand nature in all its forms. And so even the divisions now into biology and chemistry and physics and so on are kind of by the by. We're trying to understand how nature works. Now, that is clearly self-evidently not only useful, but essential. It's the foundation of our civilization. And so I think one of the problems, if, for example, a government decides that they're going to invest more in particular areas of science and not other areas, or curiosity driven or applied or whatever, that's why I don't like the distinctions. If you think about that, because nature's so complicated and so interconnected, and because knowledge generated in one field can and often does inform the discoveries that may be extremely useful or valuable or economically valuable or whatever in another field, I think we're not smart enough to predict, to say, if I invest in this particular limited area of knowledge generation, then we will solve these particular problems. I mean, I know Nancy's going to talk about graphene, I suspect, in about from now graphene. It's a very good example of a completely curiosity-led discovery. Absolutely. Andre Geim's Nobel Prize speech emphasized that it was his Friday afternoon job, right? It was literally the time when he had just this creative time to think about things. Now, graphene, and Nancy, I think, will know more than me about the current applications, but there are applications, for example, one of them in water filtration, for example, which may well end up contributing to better health outcomes and solving many of the problems with fresh water in developing countries. Now, that was not as a result of investment in a project to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. It was a result of curiosity-driven science generating new knowledge. And so that's the long answer to a short question, is that I think that we have to look at the generation of knowledge and then the application of that knowledge as what it is, which is it's a rather unpredictable process. Mm-hmm. The only thing that's predictable is that the more people you have doing it and the better the support is, the more new knowledge we will generate.
And I think, is it true to say that actually that kind of curiosity-led science is also one of the key pillars of capitalism? And the reason I ask that question is there has been discussion around that kind of separation of the function of capitalism and science, but it does seem that the two are extremely entwined.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if our economies, we call them knowledge economies. I think everybody accepts the fact now that a modern 21st century economy is a knowledge economy. And what is knowledge and where is it generated? It's obviously generated in the private sector, in the public sector, and so on. But I would say that it is self-evidently true that the education sector, from research intensive universities all the way through to apprenticeship schemes and more technical led education, the whole lot. That's where you not only generate knowledge, but actually equip people to generate and apply new knowledge. It seems so obvious to me that it's, but it's worth saying and emphasizing.
Yeah. And Nancy, you know, from your, you know, perspective leading an institution, do you see any kind of pushback where at times where finances are constrained for whatever the reason, you know, is there a push to, you know, cut those basic sciences? And in your view, you know, what is the role of those basic sciences at times of crisis and also in our wider field of discovery?
So there has been, we have been constrained in support for, if you like, curiosity-driven research. Interestingly, we have a current government who is wishing to invest more in it because they see that unless you have those discoveries, you haven't got anything to apply or to innovate with. And now fewer and fewer companies actually invest heavily in discovery. They're much more on the application. So universities, you know, are the core places now, that and research institutes like CERN, where Brian works, like Jodrell Bank he's sitting in front of at the moment, which collects information from outer space. Who knows what that's going to tell us? It might tell us about the next global pandemic. But Brian gave the really good example of graphene. And for those of you, those of you not familiar, this is the thinnest known single atom thick carbon material that was a curiosity discovered by two scientists at the University of Manchester with sticky tape and a bit of graphite, what's in a pencil. And is now being applied to lightweighting of aircrafts, to energy capture, to batteries, to biomedical applications, to cleaning up water, to storing water, to just almost everything you can imagine. They never envisaged that. And it's actually happened quite quickly. 10 years since the Nobel Prize, and it's already exploding. But you don't know what's around the corner next. And where Brian works at CERN, I mean, that is the origin of the internet. You know, a local tool was all it was. So I think, and actually the UK is really good at discovery. We probably could do a little bit better at applying it, but we're really good at discovery.
Yeah. And actually, just on that point where you know, I think, you know, the United Kingdom's always had this incredible pedigree internationally in science. And in your view, Nancy, do you think that that's very much the case in terms of, you know, our capability that we project internationally? Is this one of the things which we as a nation are really extraordinary at versus, I say versus, not in a confrontational way, but versus the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, by almost every measure, the UK is amongst the top three. And actually, if you take those measures per pound spent, we're number one. I would actually add, as a scientist, many aspects of humanities and discoveries in humanities. It was incredible. I viewed some very, very ancient medical manuscripts that we could read by using modern medical imaging techniques in our John Ryland's library. And it told us about the origins of modern medicine, about things we didn't know before. So understanding our history, the world around us, people's behaviours, incredibly important. Another really good example is we pretty much, on the pandemic theme, managed to eradicate Ebola. A lot of that was through understanding human behaviors and social anthropology. Without that, we wouldn't have understood how we could deliver treatments and vaccines into people in remote parts of Africa.
Wow. And Brian, on this particular point, is that something which you see in your field as well? And it'd be great, perhaps, you know, for those watching who maybe don't understand the distinction, you know, how does basic science and basic research relate to that wider, in inverted commas, field of research as we might understand it?
Well, I mean, if you take an example, so let's talk about CERN. So what does it actually do? It's it was established back in the 1950s, actually as part of the reconstruction of Europe, the peaceful reconstruction of Europe after the war, it must be remembered. And its job is to investigate the constituents of matter and the forces between them. So we're trying to understand the basic workings of the universe, essentially, for no reason. And it's in the constitution, it should be said, of CERN. And by the way, just one point, which is often, you often see criticism of these big scientific projects, a Large Hadron Collider, you know, we sell it, it's almost our own fault, we sell it as the biggest and most complex machine ever built, 27 kilometers in circumference underneath Geneva and part of France. That sounds really expensive. And so it sounds as if, you know, why would you spend all this money for just generating knowledge for the sake of curiosity? One thing is that the budget of CERN is about the same as the budget of the University of Manchester, actually, give or take. But it's paid for by hundreds of countries, about 35 primary countries, mm-hmm. I think. So it's a great example of how you can do cutting edge science by everybody chipping in a bit rather than one country paying every. I mean, one single country probably can't afford something like that. But what has it done? Well, as well as generating new knowledge about the fundamental workings of nature, the latest, most famous, I suppose, being the Higgs particle, which I could talk about forever, but I won't unless you want me to. But it's a bit like the Apollo program, I think, in the sense that when you try to do something very difficult, what happens is you attract the world's best engineers and scientists and designers. And in terms of the Large Hadron Collider, refrigeration systems, the whole thing runs at 1.9 degrees above absolute zero, so minus 270 degrees Celsius or so less, which is difficult. So you attract the world's best people there and give them a focus. So they invent things. They invent new industrial processes. We had to invent new industrial processes to develop superconducting cable, which is now part of virtually every, I suppose, medical imaging machines and power transmission systems of the future and so on, high field magnets. So you are forced to innovate because you have a very clearly defined goal and it's very, very difficult. And I think that's one of the key points. It was certainly the Apollo program, very similar. There's a great quote by George H.W. Bush, who said that Apollo was the best investment since Leonardo da Vinci was given a sketchbook, right? And it's true, because the impact of CERN, Nancy mentioned one impact, which is unquantifiable, which is the World Wide Web. Why was the World Wide Web invented? It was invented to solve a very specific challenge, which again goes back to something Nancy said, which was it was the challenge of large data in big international collaborations. That's why there's a very specific need for something that allowed scientists all over the world collaborating across the world to access large data sets and to speak to each other. And that's why we did it at CERN.
Yeah.
And I'll just give you one last statement, actually, talking about history. There's a great document which I often show in my talks, which was Tim Berners-Lee's proposal. I think it was 1987, I think, the initial proposal, and it said World Wide Web, an information management system. And his supervisor, his line manager, wrote vague but exciting on it, gave it back. But crucially, he had the space to do it, just as Andrei Geim and Kostya Novoselov in Manchester, because of the way that Manchester works, by the way, as a university, had the space to do this research, which wasn't funded or wasn't generating big grants. That Tim Berners-Lee was allowed to do this because of the culture of the place. Yeah. And that's, I think, central. There's one last point I'd make, which I saw this morning, actually, which is about this innovation culture, which actually runs counter slightly to the idea that it's all about money, right? It isn't actually all about money. It's about the culture and the people you have. This morning, someone gave a quote by, I don't know why, but from Steve Jobs. And he pointed out that if you think it was about money, like transforming personal computing, IBM had 100 times the R&D budget of Apple.
Yeah.
But Apple were the people that did it because of the culture. So just a warning, it's not just about spraying billions of pounds in, it's about the culture of the institutions as well, which is also the thing that we have in this country.
Can I just add to that? I mean, Brian makes a really important point about the basis of CERN, which of course William was very supportive of when he was in post.
Well,
next to Jodrell Bank is the Square Kilometre Array, the headquarters, which again is a multinational collaboration to look into deep space. But the best example I can think of transcending borders is the Sesame Project in Jordan. It's the fourth generation light project. And the members of that are Syria, Pakistan, Israel, Palestine, nations that would never normally come together. But research and science, they pay no heed to borders or political differences. And it is an incredible way of building across geopolitical divides.
Wow. And actually, just staying on this point for a moment, Nancy, which is, you know, across an institution of the scale of the institution that you lead, how do you keep that culture alive? Because, you know, universities now have such competing stakeholders when it comes to funding and delivery, but you have to keep that culture that Brian spoke of and you spoke of very much alive if we want to change the future.
You do, and we're 40,000 students and 12,000 staff, each doing their own little bit and their own little thing in their own little place. And I think in the end, it's never forgetting what the purpose of a university is. We're always worried about money, we're always worried about attracting students, but in the end, knowledge, wisdom, humanity, which is the logo, if you like, that has been for nearly 200 years for the University of Manchester, and trying to keep coming back to that is what it's about. And all else will follow from that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, you know, we are today celebrating World Asteroid Day. And, one of the jobs of science is actually to keep us safe. And we've seen that in recent times where the whole world has turned to scientists as our potential salvation from the current crisis. But, you know, just a brief cursory glance through the United Kingdom's risk register tells us that a pandemic has been front and centre of risk for many years. And so, whilst not wishing to take this conversation to a fatalistic route, you know, what else should we be worried about that science is keeping us safe from?
Well, you mentioned one, which is asteroid impact is a very low probability but very high risk, one of these so-called black swan events. So we know, of course, that asteroids have impacted us in the past and caused immense damage. The dinosaurs are a good example, but there have been many other examples of asteroids that are really city-sized asteroids that could destroy cities. Very famous one in Siberia in 1911, I can't remember, the early 1900s, which demolished about 20, 30 miles of forest. You know, that happened to be over a forest. If it was over a city, you'd have a lot of problem. So these things are, I think you're right to say, I've lost track of the number of discussion panels and radio programs and so on I've been on where we've discussed what you might call existential risks to humanity. Martin Rees, who many people know, has written a book about this recently. He's talked about it for many years. We were actually talking about it yesterday. He thought that we'd be lucky to survive another 100 years as a civilization right now. But the reason is that nature is not benign. And I think it's a mistake that we always often make, that we think that if we're just careful and we just don't really intervene, then it will be this kind of beautiful paradise that we live on and everything will be fine. This pandemic shows us that's not the case, by the way, because nature produces things. We're in a fight, essentially, with pandemic disease and new diseases all the time. But also, astronomically, it's one of the most difficult things to understand about our planet. And when you ask the question, how many planets may support intelligent civilizations in a typical galaxy like the Milky Way, one of the most difficult things to understand is that you tend to get the answer none when you do that, knowing what we know, because we live in a violent universe. The stars are ever changing. There's lots of stuff flying around in solar systems that impacts planets. You only have to look at the surface of the moon to know that we don't live in a benign environment, because there's a record of it written across the surface. So, well, I think we're probably very, very lucky indeed to be here. I'm one of the people who, if asked to guess, would say that the average number of civilizations per galaxy may be of order one, because you need to preserve a stable ecosystem on a planet in a dangerous environment, in our case, for about 4 billion years to go from the origin of life to a civilization, a third of the age of the universe. Unlikely. We're in a position now where we can do something. We can do something about the threat from pandemic disease. We can do something about the threat from space. And we do. It sounds like science fiction, but we invest in telescopes to plot the orbits of near-Earth asteroids that cross the orbit of the Earth. We have a reasonable early warning system, mm-hmm. and we have the beginnings of the ability to deflect them if we detect them early enough. And then if that threat manifests itself and we see one, we will be very happy that people mm-hmm. like, well, going back, NASA, European Space Agency, Elon Musk, and so on, develop rockets. I mean, I'll leave you with Carl Sagan's very famous quote, which is not a ridiculous one, which when he said if the dinosaurs had had a space program, they'd still be around. And it's very funny, but it's actually true as well.
Wow. Yeah. And William, we'll come back to you in just a moment with client questions. But Nancy, you know, I just would like to just turn to your area of research as well, because, you know, you've done groundbreaking research on immunology and interplay with the brain. And, you know, in your view, from the research you've done, you know, how well do we really understand our brains now? Because in some ways, you know, our understanding of the universe and our understanding of the brain are at similar levels in their journey. And do you think that this kind of research helps us at a time like this?
Can I just jump in and say we understand a lot more about the universe than we do about the human brain, I would say.
I would agree. I mean, it is the most complex thing that we've come across, not because of scale like the universe, but because of multiple interactions. And so what do we understand about the brain? Lots about the basics, not very much about the complexities. And there's a massive cross-European project called the Human Brain, trying to rebuild the human brain effectively. Mm. And there's a lot of activity around that in Manchester. But a lot of the things we are long against. But it's interesting you mention immunology, and coming back to where we are now, what one of the things we discovered was that a lot of people know that many diseases we have are because our own bodies respond inappropriately, often too much rather than too little. So we have too big an immune response. That's what kills most people with COVID-19. And we already had in trial a drug which we believed would reduce the damage caused by strokes and brain hemorrhages by reducing that immune response. We've quickly flipped it and it's just gone into trial for COVID-19. The same
thing. Wow.
But then there is the issue that we're doing a lot of work on now. We know many people suffer from coronavirus, COVID-19, whatever you want to call it, and get well quickly. Others have long-term effects like scarring of the lungs. A very big risk factor is the area I work on, which is an increased incidence of strokes afterwards. And we're looking at that, interestingly, in collaboration with doctors in China. Wow. Because of that interplay between the immune system, our defense system, and the brain and the circulation, there could be all sorts of subsequent effects of people who've been very seriously ill that we can start to follow. But it's only really 20 years ago that we recognized that the brain even responded to the immune system. It was thought to be completely separate. The brain was encased and didn't have the same sort of responses as the rest of the body. We now know that many of these immune or inflammatory responses are not only involved in stroke and hemorrhage, but also in dementia, also in depression, schizophrenia, Parkinson's, that we're now just starting to get at some of the processes underlying neurological and psychiatric diseases. And of course, everybody's very worried about the mental health impacts of being locked down, of missing education and so on. And I think we're only just starting to scratch the surface of knowing what this will mean.
Wow. And also just for those viewing, you know, if you want to ask any questions during today's session, please do feel free to do so from the Q&A tab, just at the bottom of the screen that you'll see it. And we'll get to those client questions too. But for now, I'd like to just also pass over to William, who has a question.
Well, while people are collecting their wits after those great comments from Brown and Nancy, I'm going to cause a bit of trouble, throw a little pebble into the pool. With all your knowledge of communication of science and of working with decision takers of various kinds, how do you think it's gone in this country in the COVID crisis? And what lessons should we be learning about the interaction between science and policy making and decision taking?
So do you want me to comment first? I mean, honestly, I think it's probably too early to say. I think, you know, it's going to be some time before we understand what decisions we made and whether they were the right ones. Secondly, this is a virus like no other we've ever known before. It has a number of features that make it incredibly difficult. Not least, we know lots of people who test positive who had no symptoms whatsoever, which means infection rates are much less controllable than others. But then, and Brian will have come across this and may want to comment, there's a very, very difficult position here in the sense that the government says we're following the science, and Brian, and I completely agree with him, says there is no such thing as the science. This is too new. You know, every week or every day, there's a new paper coming out saying there's something different about infection rates. There's something different about how we manage distancing or wearing masks or not wearing masks. There's an explosion of understanding. So, you know, you're balancing out scientific points of view. And some people think science is fact. It's not. It's the weight of opinion at the time based on the evidence we have. And that can change the next day, and it is doing. But then there's the important issue of politics and what is acceptable in society. And sometimes those two things come up against each other. Because sometimes if it was absolutely perfect and you could just base every decision on the scientific evidence, you'd do X. But the reality is, there are people, and people mess up X. And so it's much, much more difficult than that. I shall never forget having a discussion with politicians during the SARS outbreak, asking why we were temperature testing people when the evidence was that it was almost no help at all. And the answer was, it makes them feel better. Now, there may have been some evidence, but there are all these important issues around human behavior, either individually or as groups and so on. So it's really, really difficult to say this was the right decision. And for different countries and different cultures, there are different things that you can impose. What will work in one country won't work in another. So while I'm sure we'll look back with the wisdom of hindsight and say, we got that wrong, we did that wrong. I would certainly have said we should have tested earlier. Mm. We should have had those tests up more quickly. But I think there's going to be an awful lot of, yeah, if we'd known that, we would have done it differently. And I think we need a bit of time to tell. I don't know what Brian thinks.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, just one thing to say is that it is, and I've said this on several interviews, it is easy to criticise politicians politicians have had to make decisions very quickly in a field in a situation where we didn't understand very much, and there are some obvious things. I think, as Nancy said, I remember at the time thinking, well, obviously testing is a good idea because you need to get data. So I think that there are some mistakes that I think are not hindsight that are pretty obvious. But in general, I would agree that we're going to have to look back and learn lessons for the next pandemic. However, there's a broader point, which is, and Nancy touched on it, this idea of uncertainty and the idea that it is absolutely wrong for a politician, a decision maker, to say that we were following the science, we were just following the science, that we were doing what the scientists told us to do. You shouldn't do what the scientists tell you to do, right? Because there are other people involved in a society. There are economists, and there are health professionals, and there are social scientists, and so on. So obviously, in a complex, fast-moving environment, you have to take the best advice you can and make a decision based on that. And definitely do not point the finger at certain groups of scientists or individuals and say, well, I just did what you told me to do. What a ridiculous thing. A Secretary of State can't say, I did what that professor told me to do. That's, that's not wrong. But this idea of uncertainty, there's a great essay, which I quote often, and if anyone's listening who wants to just read something, it's freely available online. It's Richard Feynman's essay from 1955, The Value of Science. Yeah. And it's superb. And it goes through all the standard things. What's the value of science? And so new knowledge and all these things we talked about. But the most important thing Feynman, by the way, is a great Nobel Prize winning physicist. He said the most important thing is that scientists have a great experience with uncertainty. Obviously, when you're doing research, you are at the border between the known and the unknown. You're usually wrong. Nature is a great leveler. It humiliates you on a daily basis, right? Because it's hard to understand. And that, he says, is the key thing. So it's the experience with uncertainty. And he said, I actually, as we were talking, I just got it up on the screen, because it's he calls science he named it a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance. That's what he calls science, his definition. The idea that you celebrate the fact that you don't really know, you are more ignorant than not, and you learn things and you change your mind, change your policies in this case, given new data and new ideas. And you're not afraid of that or afraid to say you've done it, but you're proud of that because it's the way that we advance and the way that we make better decisions. He points out, by the way, that you could define democracy in the same way. What is a democracy? It is a system of government which acknowledges the fact that you don't really know how to do it. Therefore, you change it every 4 or 5 years. It's built into democracy, I think. But the last, I thought I'd read you the last paragraph. I just got it up because it's superb. And it goes to the heart of this idea of uncertainty in policymaking, but also to the core of why universities are important and why this way of thinking is important. So he writes, "It is our responsibility as scientists, knowing the great progress and great value of a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance, the great progress that is the fruit of freedom of thought, to proclaim the value of this freedom, to teach how doubt is not to be feared, but welcomed and discussed, and to demand this freedom as our duty to all coming generations." That's the last
one. Wow.
Wonderful.
Absolutely. Wow.
That is beautiful. And I'd love to also now turn to some of the questions that have come in from clients as well. And, you know, we've made it a good 35 minutes without mentioning this specific word. But
without mentioning question, clients. Oh, no.
No, but a question from Nicholas, which is, Nicholas asks, "The vast majority of university opinion was against Brexit, and there were concerns about its impact on Britain's international scientific research collaboration. So where do we stand now?" And, you know, whoever wants to take that, or if you both want to make a comment, that's great too.
I think we don't know where we stand at the moment. I think we're in a position until we know what the deal is. And I think many people, including myself, accepted the referendum, but really now want a deal that means that we can, in science, collaborate with Europe, in trade with Europe, maintain those interactions. I don't think we know where we are. I mean, at the moment, the suggestion is that the UK becoming part of the European research funding would cost so many times more than we'd actually get out of it. That might be hard to justify. But we are still part of CERN.
Which is great.
Yeah.
I
think that Nancy's absolutely right. The thing is, the thing about Brexit now, as far as I'm concerned, it has happened. It's done. We did it. We're out of the European Union. And so now, to me, the challenge for us, you know, we just talked about our responsibility as scientists and educators, the challenge is to remove this question from its culture war roots, right? There can be no longer debate about whether the referendum was the right or wrong outcome because it's been enacted. And so what we have to do now is say, well, so this is separate. This is not about your worldview on sovereignty and whatever else these things are that the referendum victory for the Leave side was built on. It's now about saying that's done, but we have these, as Nancy said, we're one of the three scientific powerhouses in the world, and pound for pound, a dollar for dollar, the most effective. So how do we not only maintain that, but actually enhance it? What policies do we want to ask of government, in particular, that we need the recognition that science is an international effort? But I think that's so obvious that I'm sure it's there. So how do we build policies that allow us to still be, or be even more interconnected to the rest of the world? How do we make sure researchers can move freely? How do we make sure as universities we can attract international students, not just economically, by the way, but for soft power reasons? I mean, one of the most important things we do, the British education system historically has been the place that world leaders come to get educated. That's really important. So how do we maintain those things, given that we are where we are? But I think from my perspective, I've come to realize that it's completely pointless regretting what happened, because that feeds in to the division, and we need to not feed into division. So I think you have to put it to one side. That's my sort of personal view.
Mm. Great. Thank you. And next question from John on an equally big topic, which is, John asks, what difference can science offer for us on the climate? So he uses the example, could we create a system to remove CO2 from the atmosphere sufficiently quickly and in sufficient quantities to avert the extreme potential consequences of climate change, such as rising seas and extreme weather? And what difference can science offer us in this fight against climate? And I think it's a great question for both of you, because the, you know, the university itself is also doing a lot of work in this area, I believe.
Yeah, we have a major Tyndall Centre and a big environmental sciences centre. I mean, he's effectively talking about carbon capture, which is not without its problems, but is one. But actually, aside from changing human behaviour, which is hard, I think science will be the solution. It will be the only solution. And already there are a huge number of things like new batteries, hydrogen as a fuel, other forms of energy capture and storage, whether it's solar, I mentioned some of the things that we're working on. And I think it will come not from one, but a whole range of breakthroughs that I think will deliver it. The question is, will it deliver it quickly enough? Mm. Because we are going to have behavioural change at the same time.
Yeah, it's a timing issue, really. I think it's quite dangerous and expensive, by the way, to expect that a great engineering project or great advances in particular areas of science will solve the problem. Therefore, we don't really need to address emissions at the moment. That's not the way to think about it. So I think it's as Nancy said, there isn't a lot. The window is narrowing, and what happens is if you allow emissions to continue to rise at the current rate, and therefore we allow the climate to change at the current rate, it is going to be significantly more expensive to solve the problem. And it's not that far down the line. It's not 50 years down the line. That's the thing. It's going to become very expensive very quickly. So it's a synchronization thing. It's yes, invest in the technologies, but it's also reduce emissions at the same time. And then you hopefully they dovetail and you solve the problem.
Great. And the next question is from Daniel. And I think it's a really interesting point, because so Daniel asks, how can financial organizations like Coutts support the sciences? But I think this also just raises the wider question around the role of, you know, commercial partners and business in supporting the sciences as well.
So that might be a question for William, actually. Yeah, organizations like Coutts can help in a number of different ways. I mean, like most universities, we have a lot of commercial partnerships. Highly relevant to Coutts, and your staff were there. We've just launched a big initiative in fintech, which is, if you like, the digital equivalent of banking, with a new chair and a major investment. So they could be partnership deals. Organizations like Coutts support scholarships for students who are disadvantaged, or individual customers also might support programs. And we've had a series of events, actually. Brian and I did one at Jodrell Bank. And as a result of that, one of your customers who attended put in significant support for our student mental health center as a result of it. And that was really valuable. Didn't support Jodrell, that's fine. I thought it was wonderful, but they actually wanted to support student mental health, which was just brilliant.
Just say one brief word on what I think companies in the financial services sector can do above all, which is to look, I mean, we manage getting on for 30 billion of investments on behalf of clients. And we've taken the view not to set up socially responsible options, but to put the whole of our investment policy through a filter which looks at at what the underlying companies are doing. Because we think it's not just an option now, it's got to be for all investment. And we've published, I'm rather proud of it, our sustainability statement on our website last week. Now, it's not perfect yet, but I think financial services are in fact incredibly important in this battle, because we're saying to people, look, you're going to have stranded assets. You go on investing in these things, which are the last tech, which have caused the problem. They're not going to be worth anything in 20 years' time. You've got to be ahead of the game. You've got to be investing in the new stuff. So, which is going to help solve the problem. So I do think financial services companies like ours
If I could just add briefly to that, the University of Manchester's just done the same. We were under a lot of pressure to disinvest from oil and gas, and that always made me nervous because it's just sort of cherry picking one part of it and not looking at and indeed, if you looked at the carbon footprint of our investments, oil and gas was less than 5%. So what we've committed to is not just disinvesting from oil and gas, like Coutts, but the whole lot, decarbonising the whole of the investment portfolio and repositioning it towards renewable.
Wow. And a question actually for Brian from Claire. And I think this is particularly pertinent when you look historically at the interplay between, you know, philosophy and science, for example. But Claire asks, how do sciences and humanities interact together at a university level?
It's, as I said before, it's a very, it's an important question. We perhaps don't interact as much as we as I would like. We Manchester's at the forefront actually of encouraging interdisciplinary and multi departmental sort of seminars and so on, and Nancy will comment as well on that. But I think, as I said at the start, I don't, not only do I dislike the silos that we impose on science, physics, chemistry, biology and so on, but I don't like the silos we impose across all of the university. That knowledge to me is a continuum. It's a bit like in biology when things are divided up into species, and it's not a very useful distinction. Actually, it can be a bit useful in a taxonomic sense, but it really doesn't make any sense when you understand life and the way that life works. And it's the same, I think, with knowledge in a university. The word's really important. It's a university. So human knowledge, I see absolutely as a continuum and equally valuable across all the different parts of that spectrum, I think, ultimately. What can I say? I see, as I said, to summarize, I don't really, the differences, I think, the distinctions are melting away anyway in a modern university, but maybe Nancy will comment.
Yeah, it'd be great to get your views, Nancy.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who almost chose a career in fine art rather than science, I've always been a great proponent. I went to art college. But let me just give you one example. My research is on stroke and brain disease. And there is incredible work ongoing, some of it at the University of Manchester, on using performance to help people who have suffered brain damage or people who are born with difficulties. And there's an amazing film, you can probably find it somewhere on YouTube, of a lady, not that old, with dementia, and her husband is trying to communicate with her, and she throws his arm away and grunts back. Her daughter puts music on, and the lady sings perfectly with every word and flings her arm around her husband and kisses him. That's an incredible example of the power of performance on behavior, on disease. And there are loads of examples. And I always argue creativity is not the domain of just the creative disciplines. Creativity is just as important in science. People always think of scientists as being very logical, progress and step by step. Actually, most great things in science come from an intuitive leap or somebody going way outside their field or just spotting something. I think the way we do science and humanities is actually not that different.
Just something that occurs to me, actually, a much more esoteric example. But if you think about cosmology, which is one of my research interests and areas of interest, it raises questions that are very profound and touch on ideas of meaning, for example, that doesn't really exist, it would seem, in cosmology or astrophysics. Meaning, what does it mean? What do the discoveries mean? And it reminds me of, I was asked to give a talk at a convention of Catholic bishops, a big convention, all full of virtually all the Catholic bishops in the country, about cosmology. And so I presented the modern view of cosmology, and in particular, the idea that's gaining traction because of data and theoretical understanding that maybe the universe didn't have a beginning in time. So we know there was a Big Bang, which is a time when the universe was very hot and very dense, 13.8 billion years ago, because we've measured that. But we don't know whether that was the beginning of time, and indeed whether there was a beginning in time. So that's interesting. It's a scientific question. Right? Did the universe have a beginning, or is it eternal? It's a scientific question. What does that mean for society? In this case, I asked the bishops, what does it mean If we discover, which we haven't yet, by the way, if we discover, very likely there is no origin to the universe, what place is there for a creator? I asked them, and because I didn't know, and I thought it was an interesting philosophical and theological question. A very powerful question.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't get an answer.
Not surprised.
It's a discussion, but that's a key point. What we're doing often, particularly I think in cosmology, but in research into the origin of life is another example. Mm. There are profound questions and challenges to the way that we exist and think as human beings, to our structures, our belief systems. These things interact, obviously, because we're talking about knowledge about the world that we live in. How you interpret that, what it means, and how we might change our behavior or otherwise, given those discoveries, are not the province of scientists. Partly they are, but not exclusively, obviously. I've just given you a good example. What does it mean if the universe didn't have a beginning? I think that does mean something.
Yeah. Wow. And on a similar vein, a question for you both from David. And David asks, do we have a sufficient diversity of views within the science community to spur the kind of curiosity we need to answer some of these big questions?
So I hope so. We can always do more. Science really welcomes irreverent people, people who, and I don't mean irreverent in a religious sense, I mean people who question, who do things differently, who are challenging. I would urge you to go and watch the Nobel speech of somebody who's been mentioned, André Geim, in Stockholm. And it's a huge event. I was there. It was amazing with the King of Sweden and the Queen and everybody else. And André was the first to speak. And knowing what he is like, I was starting to dread this occasion. And he said, I want to tell you the three things that are wrong with science. And he proceeded to tell the audience, which came up with rapture. I won't go into it, but rapturous applause. Because, but actually, you need mavericks, actually, and you need to welcome them. And they can be difficult, but they're always good to have.
You know, I'll just say, actually, we're just before we came on air, we were talking about UK science policy, and the name Dominic Cummings came up, as I'm sure it does often. You know, remember that job advert he got into trouble for? Maverick.
Misfit.
Windows, I think it was, or Misfits, or whatever he asked for in the civil service. That's basically what a university is, right? It's an organization that allows people to think. Ultimately, that's the purpose of the university. And it's interesting because this is, Nancy might not agree entirely with it, but one of the things I think is wrong is the measurement culture in university. And this particular idea, which I always challenge civil servants about when I meet them, is the idea of accountability for public funds, accountability for this and that. And the fact that, I always say, what does it mean? What's the point of it, first of all? Can you tell me why it's, other than this kind of wishy-washy moral idea that we have to be careful with taxpayers, what does it actually mean? And how, if you build these complicated measurement systems in order to tick boxes and fill in your forms about how you've been accountable and responsible, what does that do to this bunch of people that we all sort of understand we want there to be somewhere in society where these people can think these thoughts because it's a very valuable thing, exactly as Dominic Cummings wants in the civil service. We have them in universities already. So do we over measure? Do we try to make people conform?
I agree with you. I agree. We're more and more accountable all the time and spend fortunes on it. But the only thing I would say is, I mean, universities surely are a place where you have the weirdos and the misfits. Makes it a hell of a job trying to manage it.
Can I put in one word there? Because one of the most fascinating problems for a decision taker, for a minister, is to deal with the outliers. I was involved in a previous crisis, the BSE crisis, where everybody took the view, the consensual view was that this was like scrapie and sheep, so it wouldn't. Transmit to you. And good scientists said that, and it was a perfectly logical thing to say. And Bill Stewart, it was a great man, it was my chief scientific advisor, the government's chief scientific advisor, said, well, let's be careful. So I said, well, what do we do? Let's go and talk to Stanley Prusiner, he said, who discovered these strange things called prions. And I remember having lunch with Stanley Prusiner, and I tried to get him to say, this isn't going to transmit. And, you know, nobody knows. Nobody knows. Yeah. And I left that lunch thinking, that's right. Nobody knows. We've got to be careful.
Did you have a steak?
Problem against the always really difficult. The weirdo may be right, or he may be really wrong. We also had a whole lot of lunatics. I'm afraid that if any's listening to them now, I apologize. Who said it was all caused by organophosphate sheep dips? Well, it wasn't caused by organophosphate sheep dips. There were other problems to do with that. And you have to say deciding which of the outliers, which of the weirdos to listen to, is jolly difficult sometimes.
Wow. I think that's a leadership challenge, I think, for all of us in our industries. And, you know, I'm conscious of the time as well. And so if I could just take this opportunity to thank Brian and Nancy for joining us today. It's been a truly fascinating and insightful discussion. And I'd love to hand over now to William for a vote of thanks and to draw us to a close today. Oh, I think
you're on mute, William. William?
Many people would say that's a good place for me to be. I've talked to already today. But I would like to just redouble Vikas's thanks to Nancy and to Brian for taking time, because my goodness, these are busy people. And to say it's a reminder to us of one of the immense strengths of our nation and one of our immense contributions to the world, that we have such a powerful university system and such wonderful scientists and engineers and technologists in this country. That is something we can be proud of and should be proud of. And you've had a wonderful example of that, of two of the most fascinating and two of the best communicators amongst them. So thank you, both of you, very much indeed.
It's a pleasure. And by the way, if there are questions that weren't answered, if you want to email them, I'm happy to answer them by email.
Same here. And just can I say thank you to Coots and everybody for joining in and arranging it. We let's have another one when we can all get together in a room. That's what I say.
We'll bring Andre Geim. He will challenge you.
Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.